This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 358 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and with Glyn away in Myanmar, I've asked Craig Wetchen to step into the chair. Craig, welcome back.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and it's be an exciting episode.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, of course.
What do you want to chat about?
What do you want to chat about? Oh, we can chat all about all kinds of things, and you know, and speaking to you the other day about this, I thought it would be, I guess, poignant to talk a little bit about photographing the moon, since we have
the
fantastic supermoon the other week.
You know what? My wife said to me, oh, I'm really surprised you're not out shooting the supermoon. And I was like, oh, really? Like, everyone's making out like this is the biggest thing since sliced bread. And I didn't believe that it would actually appear any bigger in the sky than it normally would. I mean, yes, I know that technically the moon was a little bit closer to the Earth than normal, but did it really look any bigger?
Look, you really needed, you needed a good, I guess a tree or, you know, buildings,
some frame of
low
reference
in the horizon as a reference.
Yeah, right.
Compared to what you normally see the moon at. But look, as such, it wasn't that much bigger than what you normally see. But what you got out of it was probably the intensity and the brightness that, that you really got out of the from the supermoon.
Yeah, right. Did you go out and shoot it yourself?
I certainly did.
Cool.
I certainly did. I was not as a astronomical geek I am. There's an opportunity that, you know, it's not going to be here for another 38 years, and who knows where I'll be 38 years from now, but it's an opportunity that I want to be able to see it with my own eyes and then obviously capture it as well with my own camera.
Okay, so now, just before we started recording, you mentioned you live about half an hour out of Melbourne to the east side. Are you in a like, what's the ambient light level like where you live?
The ambient level would be, I guess, a normal suburban. There wasn't too much ambient, but I played with getting some ambient as well as getting the moon.
Oh, okay. Cool. So you had some other object in the frame? It wasn't just
the moon? I did for one of my photographs that I took. I took a shot with a tree that was illuminated by streetlights, and then I also had a headlamp, you know, one of those camping headlamps that I did a little painting with light.
Oh, cool.
So then having the moon peeking through clouds off the distance.
So should we talk about what gear you used? Should we talk about what settings you used? Should we talk how do you want to discuss this?
Oh, look, I can certainly go through, you know, what gear I photographed it with and how I went about approaching the exposure, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about the moon, and the moon is basic daylight exposure.
Yeah, right. So were you shooting from your backyard?
I did shoot a couple of shots directly from my backyard, but I also took some shots just down the street in the big open paddock that's around the corner.
Yeah, right. So obviously a tripod?
Obviously a tripod, yes, definitely a tripod, because I was shooting with a 300mm 2.8.
Oh, nice work.
Hand holding that is a bit difficult.
Sorry?
A hand holding that can be a bit difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine. I'm interested to know what white balance you shot.
I shot daylight white balance.
Yeah, nice.
So daylight white balance, I mean, you're getting a reflection of, it's reflecting the sun, and the sun is daylight color balance. So you just set it to daylight white balance, and I've got the exposure settings right there, 300 2.8 with a 1/350th of a second f/8 ISO 400.
Wow. So that's a lot faster than a lot of people would potentially think was what was needed.
Yep. And I mean, when you're talking, you know, I've read some articles and, you know, people say, you know, it's a good place to start at F11 or F16. But, you know, when we're talking 380 something thousand kilometers away, there's no such thing as depth of field. So. No.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Did you focus at infinity or a little bit back from infinity? Or
I just hit the autofocus and focused straight onto the moon.
Fair enough.
So, and yeah, with photographing the stars, there's no such thing as photo. I mean, the stars you think are at infinity, they're not actually at infinity. you can, you know, if you're using stars and you can use, you know, a street light that's about, a 100 meters or, you know, about 100 meters away, you can focus on that and then point it to the sky. And especially if you're using a wide angle lens.
Yeah, right.
The rest will be taken care of for itself. But it's usually when you look on the lenses, you can, you know, the lenses have a window at the top.
Yep.
And, you know, a good time to test where you would be photographing the stars is to go out on a night with the moon and autofocus on the moon, then look at the window and see where it sits. Your focusing sits on
the range scale. Lens. Yeah.
Yeah, on the lens scale. That's right. And it's usually on the Canon. I've got a Canon 5D and a Wendy Mark IV, but I shot the moon on a 300-28 and the same little markings on the Canon lenses. Nikon's got pretty much the same sort of markings as well, but it just passed just a little bit before infinity. There's a white line and usually a line that goes vertical as well, and that's usually about where focusing on the stars and the moon is.
Right. So it is just a little bit back from infinity.
It's a little bit back from infinity. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Cool. So I guess that's employing the principles of hyperfocal distance, where, you know, your point of focus usually means that you've got one third in front and two thirds behind.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and so it was an opportunity to, you know, to go out and I guess enjoy something that, you know, you're only going to see every once in a while. And look, it certainly was extremely bright. It was 35% brighter.
Oh,
than
wow.
A normal moon.
Wow.
Yeah, because even after I photographed it, I took out the telescope and it was blinding looking through the telescope.
Is that right?
It was, yes.
Wow. How did you frame the shot with the moon and the tree that was lit?
So with the moon and the tree, I played around with the 300. The 300, the tree was really, really out of focus because obviously it was so close.
For sure.
So I then ended up changing to a 35. 1.4 and used really a wide angle lens and used the tree as a point of reference. Now, obviously, because the exposure between the tree and the moon is so great,
yep.
I ignored the exposure of the moon and went for more of the ambiance,
right.
The ambient light in and around the tree that I was photographing. So the moon was blown out by about at least 4 or 5 stops.
Yep.
But the rest of the atmosphere, the sky was blue, the clouds were, you know, moving because I did a 30-second exposure.
Oh, nice.
And, but yeah, the tree, the clouds and everything looked absolutely magnificent. And, you know, the moon, I didn't care about the fact that it was blown out. I was going more of that ambiance and that, you know, with the moon lighting up the clouds and the clouds having some motion to it. So.
Nice.
It's always good to differentiate your photos as well and to experiment. I mean, that's the biggest thing with photography is experimentation.
Definitely.
And so I experimented with that and obviously just and pointed the camera up to the moon with the 300-28 and just, yep,
so
bang.
So I'm interested to know, when you changed to your 35mm and went for the wide shot,
yeah,
did you still shoot a daylight white balance, even though I imagine that the street light shining on the tree would have had more of a, you know, an impact on the overall image than would the daylight balance of the moon. So I wonder, did you bother changing to a tungsten white balance or whatever type of street lighting it was under? Did you cater for that or did you stay daylight?
No, I stayed daylight. I stayed daylight because I wanted the moon and the sky to stay the color for which I wanted it to be. You know, the streetlights certainly were a very iridescent orange.
Yep.
But you know, my headlamp was a daylight balanced. So when I painted the tree was it had a daylight balance to it with a tint of orange.
Oh, nice.
So it's nice to add color to your shots.
Oh, for sure.
You know, Bruce?
Yeah, definitely.
And when you're photographing the moon, it's quite a sterile environment, isn't it? It's pretty much a gray card.
Yeah, yeah.
So having the moon and the sky, I guess a quote unquote normal color, even though the moon was blown out.
Yeah.
But I went for more of that, I guess, color feel.
Nice. Nice. Yeah.
Why not?
All right. Any other tips that you want to share with regards astrophotography that you think might be worth?
Look, I think when photographing the moon, you know, one of the things is, of course you can photograph the full moon. I think the moon when it's in its crescent, whether it's, with a bit of a crescent, you get that nice little gradation on the moon, and it helps accentuate some of the texture that the moon's got.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you want the stars, well, obviously you want the stars without the moon.
Yeah, yeah.
So you find a night when you've got a new moon.
Yep.
And then you go out and you photograph the stars, and the stars are another little... it's an experimentation with photographing the stars.
They're a tricky beast.
They are a very tricky beast. But, you know, I think the tips that I've learned through the years and learned that I've learned from, you know, lots of other photographers just spend, you know, half their life or more than half their life just photographing the stars.
Yep.
You want wide angle lens. So you'd want to stick to a 24 or even wider.
Yep.
Because, you know, the Earth is moving very fast.
Yeah. That's right.
Which obviously the stars are moving because the Earth is moving so fast. But the wider the lens, the less the impact of the motion.
That's it. Yep.
And when you do that, you can shoot about maybe 4, maybe an 8 second exposure. But I'd be urging on, you know, sticking around the 4 second exposure. Obviously, you don't have to go. You know, ISO 1600s probably with today's cameras is a very acceptable ISO because I don't think you need to go any higher than that.
Right.
But you also want to shoot at wide open 2.8.
Yep.
Because, you know, depth of field is irrelevant. You know, if you've got a 1.2 or 1.4, yeah, you might want to stop down to F2, you know, just to get rid of the, you know, some of your aberrations around the edges.
Yep.
And you want to shoot as wide open as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
To allow that light to come in and hit that sensor.
Yeah. Yeah. I took a couple of guys out to Coonabarabran probably 18 months ago now, I guess. And actually, it would have been the middle of winter last year, so it was probably about 15 months ago. And we found a nice hilltop where they actually have their little airstrip up on a hilltop just outside of town. And we went out there in the middle of the night and freezing cold.
Yeah, yeah.
But that made for perfect conditions. You know, cold, crisp air tends to be a little clearer for...
A lot clearer, yeah.
For that type of photography. And I have a 20mm 2.8 wide prime. And so I shot my panos with that.
You got to be prepared for your night photography for sure. You got to bundle up, especially if it's going to be a chilly night.
Definitely.
You got to have the skeeter spray on.
Yeah. Well, if it's a warm night, yes, definitely.
If it's a warm night, you need that.
Yeah.
You might not want to get too warm, otherwise you might have some creepy crawlies crawling around middle of the night. But
if you are going out on a cold night, take a pot of coffee with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the last little tip, if you're doing night photography as well, is because you want to be able to see as much as possible, is you don't want a white light. You want a red light.
Yep.
You want like a red headlamp. So red, because your eyes aren't so influenced by or aren't overwhelmed by.
Yes, they don't ruin your night vision.
Correct. Yeah. So a red lamp is what's really good for your night vision.
And I think the red light tends not to have as great an impact should you inadvertently spray it across the scene that you're shooting as well.
Well, that, yeah. But, more so, definitely it doesn't affect your eyesight as much as white light.
Yeah.
Light would. So, but yeah, look, it's an opportunity to go out and have fun. You know, we even use a white light and paint the landscape.
Yeah.
While you're shooting the stars.
Yep. Yeah, well, I think when I did my pano out there at Coonabarabran, I just used not even a daylight balance torch, but just a regular battery-powered torch, and I shone it across the tree that I had chosen for my foreground interest just to bring a little bit of detail out of the tree so it didn't just, you know, dissolve into a silhouette.
Yep.
And that did the job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So... But yeah, so go out, experiment, photographing the moon, photographing it full, even if you photograph it as a crescent, it's still daylight balance.
Yep.
And it's also a basic daylight exposure. So that's your ISO. We've probably gone over that before, haven't you?
Probably. It's interesting, you know, what you're saying about shooting 300 mil, but at an F8, it means that you don't have to have a 300 f/2.8 lens. You know, you could do this with a kit lens.
Absolutely.
You know, because, you know, even a kit lens will allow you to shoot at f/8 at 300 mil.
Absolutely. And, you know, you really want a 300 mil or longer. Though if I was photographing a 300 mil lens, it was still, you know.
It was longer, I'll bet.
I wish it was at least a 900 because, you know, it was still a little pinhole in the photograph practically, you know. I think when I cropped it down to a just about a 900
right
kilopixel.
Okay, right. Yeah.
So
right.
I was below the megapixel.
Yeah, right.
If you know what I mean. That's how small, even with a 300, it was about the size of a little bit bigger than an eraser, you know, pencil eraser head.
Right.
But it was still, you know, now, through the viewfinder, it looked magnificent through the viewfinder.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you have also got a telescope. Do you have a camera adapter for that?
I don't. And my telescope is I bought it with my altitude rewards points.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Celestron. It's a good telescope. But I tell you what, it shakes like the worst earthquake on the planet.
Is that just a matter of getting a heavier tripod for it? Or is there more to it?
That probably would help.
Right.
But, you know, it all comes down to funding, Bruce. I've got my camera equipment these days.
Wait, we're coming up to that time of year. Maybe you need to drop some hints.
It's funny you should say that, dropping some hints. I just bought the new Sigma 85.
Oh, nice. The Art Series?
The Art Series.
Oh, sweet.
Yes. And I read the latest news report from Petapixel the other day, and I was just salivating, and I was just like, I just wish I had it in my hands. I've got a deposit on it, and I'm just waiting for it to be delivered.
Oh, okay. And what's the expected delivery time?
Well, they said within a week, and now it's been 2 weeks.
Oh, damn.
So... Yeah. But I'm just waiting for that phone to ring because
I can't wait
to play with this lens.
Yeah. That's a 1.4, if I'm not mistaken, or is it a 1.2?
Yeah, 1.4.
Yeah, nice.
And, I'm going to be shooting that with my new project that I'm going to be working on.
Yeah, right. Is that the one that you mentioned last time?
Yes, I did. Dementia. It was the dementia. Yeah, what does dementia look like?
Nice. Yeah, that will be a gorgeous portrait lens.
Absolutely. Now, from everything I've read, it's a tank.
Well, that's a good thing.
It's twice as long as the Canon version.
Oh, okay.
Have a little, probably about the same weight as the Canon, but because it's longer, it's very it's very forward heavy.
Right.
But you know what? It doesn't matter. Because everything I've not to, you know, diss Canon, I love my Canon gear, but for, you know, $1,300 versus $2,500.
Yeah, gee, you can't argue with that.
Can't argue with that, and getting this maybe possibly the better quality.
Yeah, right. So I'm not overly familiar with the lens. I know that it's recently come out, but I haven't really looked at it myself. Given that it is so much longer than the Canon and given that it is so heavy, does it have a mounting sleeve on the lens like your 70 to 200s do? Or is not quite that long as to require
it's not that long. No, it's not that long. Right. It's just from the pictures that I saw, it's about 2.5 centimeters longer than the Canon 85.
Okay.
So it's not that much bigger.
But it's going to feel solid in your hands, that's for sure.
It's longer, and yeah, you feel the weight in it. But, you know, when you're trying to get 1.4 out of a lot of glass, it's still magnificent.
Yeah, nice.
So that's my latest lens acquisition, and I'm just salivating at getting my hands on it.
Now, before we started recording, or you know, earlier today when we were chatting via Facebook, you said that it'd be awesome, also worth talking about your approach to people and portraiture and shooting strangers and all that sort of stuff. And given that we've just come from talking about a new portrait lens, should we talk a little bit about that stuff?
Absolutely. That sounds great.
I mean, you've been working professionally for God knows how long. How much portrait work do you do as a part of your job?
Part of my job. I've been photographing people for, right. Now you're testing my memory.
So essentially you are saying it is a large part of your job.
It is a very large part of my job.
Right.
It is a very large part of who I am as an individual. I think talking with people.
Right.
It's about it's about the communication.
Yeah, right.
And when you're communicating with people, and especially when you want to photograph them, well, you need to speak with them and open up that conversation and show genuine interest in who they are.
For sure. So as a teenager, early 20s-ish, budding photographer, were you a naturally chatty person?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
I've always been a chatty person. I just love to talk to people. I love to know more about you as an individual, and especially if I'm going to put you in front of my camera.
Yep.
I really want to know more about you, and I like to make friends. I like to see what you do, because you know when you start talking to people, you find out so much about them and about and then all of a sudden you're like, wow, you're painting your own picture in your own head.
Yep.
And then you know exactly what you want to do, and before you know it, I mean, with my Men in the Sheds project, you know, I've had half the guys in the book didn't want to want their photograph taken. Yet by the time I went into their shed, talked to them about what they do in there, how much fun they had in there, and what is this piece that I'm looking at on their benchtop.
Yep.
They turn around, they'll turn around and say, "So where do you want me to stand?" So they're posing for me.
Yeah,
Bruce, they're posing for me. And I think that is just so enlightening from a standpoint of when I first met you an hour ago, you didn't want your photograph taken whatsoever. And now you are asking me to pose you. So I think, you know, that in itself, you know, just solidified and proved to me even more about what you do with someone who's sitting in front of your camera, whether it's a portrait or, you know, even with when I was doing my brides and grooms, you know, I believe it or not, I booked a wedding. So I'm really excited to shoot a wedding again in March. I know, but you know, all my wedding clients always got a free engagement portrait session.
Yep.
You know, and that was an opportunity for me not to worry about selling them the pictures, but me to get to know them.
Yeah.
And for them to get to know me, and before you know it, they're buying the pictures off me because it's like I wasn't trying to sell them.
Yeah, nice.
So I was trying to get to know them.
Yep.
Rather than sell them. So I think there's a lot to be said about that.
It's an interesting thing. You know, so many photographers go, they say, oh, I like to shoot candids, you know, and it's really a cover story for I don't want to talk to strangers. But I think you know, a large part of it is what you've just said. You know, if you give people an opportunity to talk about themselves, most of the time, I think it's just human nature. We're all very happy to talk about ourselves, given an opportunity.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the easiest in that there is.
Oh, couldn't agree with you any further. I mean, it's just, it's one of those things that, just communication, just opening up that line of communication, and people are happy to give when you are not asking sometimes.
Sure.
So you don't even have to ask. You just have to, you give by listening.
Yep.
And then they give back to you twofold. And that second fold is by, how do you want me to pose?
Yeah.
But it's not about posing either. It's about, you know, I don't like to pose as such, you know, put your hands here and your hands there. I like to direct. It's more about directing rather than posing. I think, you know, posing can be, I mean, if you want to say it's almost very 80s, you know, posing. It's, you know, so, okay, you like to shoot candidly. Well, that's great. Well, why don't you direct while they're being candid? And even though that they're being candid, you're still directing because you're asking them to go stand over by that tree.
Yeah.
So you got to direct. You've got, as a photographer, you've got to be human. You've got to be a technological, you know, freak when pulling the rabbits out of the hat when something goes wrong when you're shooting.
Yeah.
But you also have to be, you got to be very nimble and think on your feet and direct and communicate and crack a joke.
Yeah.
Have fun with the situation.
Yeah.
Because the more you have fun, the more your people in front of your camera are going to have fun.
Yeah. And I think if you get them talking about themselves, quite often they will start to move in a way that is very natural to them.
Yeah.
And I think you can, you can lock in onto that once you've got them chatting away.
Absolutely. And Bruce, you know, one of the things that I teach as well is that when you're chatting, the thing is, what you can do is you can observe as a photographer. You're observing on how the light is falling on their face or it's not falling on their face.
Yeah.
So you can stop, and as you stop, they might stop and turn around, and before you know it, they're turning around into the light.
Yeah.
And you go, ah, stay right there. Beautiful light. You look fantastic. You know, then you can, then, you know, you're, because what you're doing is you're already mentally thinking of the photographs that you're trying to take.
Yeah.
So obviously if the subject is backlit, and as you're talking with them, you can look at the light hitting the back of their head. Okay, I know exactly what I'm going to do, you know?
Yeah.
It's those sorts of things as a photographer. So you're still, you know, coming at the process with a photographic mind.
Yeah. Nice.
And it's thinking about what you want to do with it and how, with your subject. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, you know, I don't do people very well, but you do landscapes really well, don't you? Yeah. Well, make believe your people are landscapes. So vice versa, you know, I don't like landscapes, but I love photographing people. We'll turn people into landscapes.
Yeah, nice.
So, you know, I like to have fun. And that's how I have fun with when talking to people. And, like, I crack those jokes as well. You know, I'll be saying, you're my landscape, in the landscape.
Yeah.
I know that sounds kind of dorky, doesn't it?
Oh, look, whatever breaks the ice.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
And that's how, you know, you got to have fun with it. When you're having fun with the situation of you know, cracking that awkward moment when you first meet a couple and you're out there photographing, or you first meet a subject who you want to photograph because they're really interesting.
Yeah.
It's about having fun and enjoying the whole process, because photography, at the end of the day, it's fun.
Definitely.
Two words that I live by with photography is, one is having fun.
Yep.
The other is a four-letter word. Do you want to guess the four-letter word?
No.
Starts with a P. Play.
Oh, okay. Right.
I had to stomp, didn't I?
You did.
See, I'm cracking a joke with you, Bruce, right? I got you laughing.
Excellent.
Right then and there, I took about 50 photos of you, too, that quick.
Nice.
So, I mean, that's, you know, that's how I approach it, having fun and playing.
Excellent. Excellent.
And, you know, so bringing that all together is having fun with photographing the stars, photographing the moon. You're having fun.
Yeah.
You're playing. You're experimenting with, you know, introducing new areas within the landscape with the moon or with the stars. And then playing with, you know, photographing people and subjects that you find interesting and just enjoying the whole process.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, should we get on to some of the other stories that we've had submitted this week?
Certainly.
Okay. So the first link that I came up with was to the work of Julien Duvier, who has produced some absolutely fantastic cinemagraphs. I've yet to read up on how he actually does this, but I love the results. Did you get to have a look at any of these?
I'm looking at it as we speak.
They're just great. I love them. They're so clever.
Absolutely.
Really, really good work. I thought there was a link in the story there somewhere that took you off to somewhere where it explained the process. Right at the bottom.
Well, I think there that's probably one of the best things to, when you're doing these sorts of processes, and it's about explaining how the process actually all comes together.
Yep.
And that's a lot to say about a photographer and how they can explain how they're actually doing it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it just looks fantastic. I mean,
they're great.
To really incorporate the landscape, something still, but yet have something, you know, and some motion in there. It really adds. I mean, you know, as photographers, we've got to be really crafty these days.
Oh, definitely.
To really set us apart.
Yeah.
From everyone else.
Yeah.
And this is something that, you know, I just love, you know, even just this guy with the newspaper.
Isn't that great?
Newspaper just sort of flicking in the breeze. And then,
yeah.
You know, the one with the house with the little trail of smoke.
It's great.
But, you know, you look at it and you go, you want to know, how did he do it?
Yeah. I could just imagine these displayed on a wall on a digital screen, you know, just sitting there constantly in motion. It would just look fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm always trying to push my students to come up with new ideas and something to, you know, help them expand their minds photographically or visually.
Yep.
To come up with something interesting. And this is definitely on the charts of there's a lot of work going into something like this, but I'll tell you what, very captivating.
Definitely. Anyway, that link will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check that out. And the other thing that I came up with this week was, and I'm sure we've mentioned this on the podcast before, it's Time Magazine's Most Influential Images of All Time, and I think they've got about 100 of them. And you can actually view them in chronological order. There's a button that comes up on the right-hand side of the page that says View by Date, and it essentially puts them in a reverse timeline, and you've got this little slider and you can drag it all the way to the right back to like the first photographs ever taken, and you know, the famous Daguerre photograph of the street, you know, that I think took like 8 minutes to expose or something. And just some of the images in this collection are fantastic. You know, some of them are quite famous. Some of them were images I'd certainly never seen before. And some of them are, you know, quite confronting as well. You know, some of the wartime stuff is, very confronting stuff.
Absolutely. But, you know, photography is all about, I mean, this, you know, I saw this the other week.
Right.
And I posted this on one of my students' blogs.
Yeah, right.
That my educational blogs. And, you know, it's I'm always looking at things to inspire people. But, you know, photography is awe-inspiring. I mean, you know, I look at some of these photographs and I actually look, there's a photograph of, you know, man on the moon, Neil Armstrong.
Yeah.
There's a photograph of the earth with the moon in the foreground. But, you know, you look at these photographs and you go, wow, I remember this when it was published, or I've seen, you know, Tiananmen Square.
Yes.
Come on, yeah. That 1989, I knew exactly where I was when I look at that photograph. I knew all about that. And then, you know, the milk drop, Harold Edgerton.
Yeah, right.
I loved his work. I mean, I studied his work when I was getting my degree in photography.
Yeah, right. And that was 1957.
I know. And I still have students who want to try to do that.
And I'm sure that would have been really cutting-edge stuff for its day.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, a great collection of images. Anyway, once again, that link will be in the show notes for anyone that wants to check them out. Like I said, definitely some very confronting stuff in there as well. David Marland sent me an email, came in, I think it was either yesterday or today, and he said something a bit different. This is from Mongolia's Got Talent. The artist, Canyon Shijabat, is cleverly combining his video, photographic, technical, graphic, and choreographic skills in this performance, all done by the one person. Photography and video are often used as backgrounds for performance, but here it is imaginatively used as an integral part of the performance. YouTube covers the before, during, and after of his segment on the show, but the real highlight is from a minute 35 through to 4 minutes 12. The rest is interesting because although most of us do not understand Mongolian, it is very plain to see what people are saying. We won't play that now because it's a YouTube link, but definitely worth having a look. And you're right, David, certainly something a little bit outside of the norm for what we normally cover on Shutters Inc., but very interesting nonetheless and very masterfully executed. And clearly the judges on the show thought so as well. Did you get a chance to have a look at it, Craig?
I have, and I thought, again, you know, that's one of those things is just as, even as music artists, and, you know, you got to find something that really sets you apart from everyone else.
Yeah, you know, and finding, you know, a couple of areas of expertise that you have and being able to combine them in a way that no one else has done is what will do that for you, you know, and clearly that's what he's done and done
absolutely.
Well.
Yep.
Adam Davidson sent us a couple of links. The first one was spray printer. Now, funny story. My wife and my son and I were sitting down watching TV tonight, and it's a sci-fi show set in the future. And there was a short scene of somebody spraying some graffiti on a wall. And basically, they were just running the can left and right, backwards and forwards across the wall. And out came this amazingly complex artwork as graffiti on the wall. And Kath made the comment of, you know, wouldn't it be crazy if, you know, graffiti was that easy? And I said, well, you won't believe this, but Adam sent this link only today to this thing called spray printer. And essentially it is a spray can of paint with an adapter that goes on the top, and you mount your phone to it, and you can, you know, load an image onto your phone and basically communicate that to this contraption that then controls the flow of the spray paint so as to recreate the artwork you've got on your phone on whatever surface you want to paint on. There's a fantastic video that shows, you know, guys, you know, who've created artwork for their business and then going and spray painting it on the side of a vehicle. And, you know, you don't have to worry about messing it up because this thing is pre-programmed that it'll just control the outlet of the paint so that you end up with the artwork as you've got it saved as a JPEG on your phone.
That's just madness.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Think about the Pixel Stick.
Yes.
You know, it's the same sort of you know, idea.
Yeah.
As the Pixel Stick.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, different medium, but a similar approach. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Crazy times we live in. And the other one was a video which I didn't get a chance to watch, Adam. I will watch it after we've recorded. But this was Elton John's photo collection. And I just had a look at some of the still images that were included in this particular blog post. And it's like he's got his own art gallery in his house. There's just walls and walls and walls that are just all hanging with, you know, all these amazing photographs. And in that second image, the one where you can see Elton John standing on the right-hand side and you're sort of looking at the back of his head, one of the images on the left-hand side is the woman with a, you know, her fingers up to her mouth, and that's one of those 100 images from Time's, you know, most influential images of all time story. So, yeah, it looks like he's got a great collection of photography hanging on his walls.
It's just to have these photos and, you know, if I do remember hearing quite some time ago, he's a very avid photographic collector.
Yeah, right. Well, it certainly would appear so from the couple of photos that are in this blog post. Is he a photographer himself?
That I don't know. I couldn't. I'll have to ask him that.
Next time you're talking to him, it wouldn't surprise me. You know, you get people in the arts, and they quite often, you know, branch out into, you know, other art forms as well.
Mm.
You know, my day job is as an audio engineer, and it is phenomenal the number of audio engineers that I know who are also photographers in their spare time. It just seems to be, you know, something that goes hand in hand. I think once you're in the creative industry in some way, you tend to look for any opportunity to express your creativity.
Yep.
So it would not surprise me one bit to find out that someone like Elton John, you know, doesn't mind picking up a camera for himself once in a while.
Yeah, well, like as you said, that image that Dorothea Lange took during I think the Great Depression.
Yep.
It's just such an iconic photo of
yes
misery, but yet happiness.
Yeah.
Mm.
All right. Well, that's all the stories we've got. Let's go to David Marland and his book review, Encyclopedias and Quickies. Sounds interesting. Go for it, David.
Thanks, Bruce. The main focus of this review is not really the actual books, but rather the approach to the books. As it happens, both of these books have a different approach and are by the same author, Scott Kelby. Scott Kelby is a fairly well-known name in photography circles, particularly in the Photoshop and Lightroom sphere. Indeed, the dust jacket of both of these books proclaims Scott as the world's number one best-selling photography technique author. But I digress. This is about a couple of how-to books. In ancient times, about 5 years ago, you would buy software in a box, and it would come with a series of discs and a printed manual. Nowadays, you pay your dollars, downloads your software, and the so-called manual, if you've got one, is online, where you can you may get a video tutorial or FAQs or even a PDF version to help you. But maybe it's because I'm prehistoric and a little more than 20 years old, but I find that process a little unsatisfactory. I think it's because manuals are usually written from an engineer perspective rather than a user's perspective. So I tend to like third-party books. My approach to software and to a lot of things is to read the quick start, have a go, familiarize myself with whatever it is, and then start getting the most out of it. But to get the most out of it, I can be seen haunting bookshops, looking through the third-party how-tos, and then purchasing one I think will work for me. I tend to look for a logical chapter flow with headings at a number of levels, so I can either read the chapter or just dip into it. And it has to be written in plain English and have a really good index. Maybe that's the scientist in me. I find these books end up fitting into two types. There's the cohesive encyclopedic type, or the quickie how-to. I've got both types of book, and looking at my shelves, I've got a long line of them on a whole range of subjects by a range of authors. One I've got is Scott Kelby's The Adobe Photoshop Lightroom 5 Book for Digital Photographers. It's a 530-page encyclopedia. It's got step-by-step instructions and lots of illustrations. I'm still using it, even though I'm in Lightroom CC, and on my shelves, it actually replaced a similar book on Lightroom 2 by someone called Nathaniel Colson. The second book is a how-to. It's a quickie, and this one's in Photoshop. It's a smaller paperback, and it's got a surprising 260 pages. It doesn't feel like it or look like it, but yeah, it's amazing. Each page has got a how-do-I question, and It's got a picture of the issue and a commentary. One-step stuff. For me, this is the sort of book I get and use after I've been having a go with something like Photoshop for a long time. Now, as you can guess, I prefer the printed versions of this sort of book, mainly because I find it easier to have it open when I'm at the computer and doing something, rather than trying to flip through on a pad or another part of the computer to see what I'm up to and how to put it all together, and it gets confusing. But whatever, it's a matter of taste. How do I do that in Photoshop as a paperback ranges from $23.50 to just over $56 in Booko. You can get it as an ebook for between $18.30 and $37. But it's interesting in the Booko list that I noticed that Rocky Nook, who are the publishers, are not on the list. So they're also worth checking to compare the price. Scott also has a How Do I Do That in Lightroom, but I haven't got a copy of that one, so I can't tell you anything about it. I suspect it's very similar to the Photoshop book. The Adobe Photoshop Lightroom CC and Lightroom 6 book for digital photographers, which is the most recent edition of the larger version, ranges between about $42 and $60. It's a Voices That Matter publication published by New Writer. But again, I urge you to go out and haunt the bookshops. You might find something more to your style of learning. It doesn't have to be these two, because it's very important that it fits the way you want to approach things. And if you can do it that way, you'll get more out of the book. Cheers.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I think that just about wraps it up.
Wow.
Short and sweet.
It is. Good fun.
Absolutely.
Talking photography.
So what have you got planned for the rest of your week, photographic-wise?
What do I have planned for the rest of my week? I went to an exhibition opening, a graduation exhibition opening tonight at Melbourne Polytechnic.
Right.
Tomorrow night I go to the gallery exhibition opening, the grad exhibition of RMIT tomorrow night.
Right.
And then I go down, nothing else. I got to teach a class on Friday. Then I go down to Rosedale on Sunday to hopefully sell lots of books.
Oh, okay. This is the Men in Their Sheds book?
Yeah, Men in the Sheds book at the Rosedale Man Cave Market.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you'll get rid of a few units there for Christmas presents.
I hope so. Last year they had 20,000 people walk through the door, so wow. Hopefully I can sell a few books.
Yeah, that's great.
That would be fantastic.
Yeah. What are you teaching on Friday?
I teach a camera class, basic camera introduction to, you know, understanding your camera and photographic genres.
Right. And through which institution is this?
Photography Studies College.
Right. And is that just Melbourne-based?
It is Melbourne-based, yes.
Yeah, nice.
Part-timers, so lots of moms with cameras and
yep.
Quite a few, accountants who are looking for change of career.
Yeah, for sure. Look, I should get from you either JPEG copies of your moonshots or at least links to where you've got them displayed online. Be nice to put in the show notes for anyone to check out. So they
can go to my Facebook page.
Okay.
You can download both those photos.
Okay.
They're the second post in.
All right. And are you okay with me putting those in the show notes as well?
Absolutely. Cool. Yeah. Sure thing.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you once again for sitting in Glenn's absence.
No, thanks, Bruce. I'm honored.
No worries. All right. Well, I've got all your contact details and I'll put those in the show notes for anyone that wants to find you and your work on the web.
No problem.
And we will talk with you again sometime.
All right. Sounds good, Bruce. Thanks again.
No worries.
See you, mate.
Bye.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
Another audio2.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.